I've always been sort of drawn toward missions that matter. I graduated from high school, went to the Naval Academy, always wanted to serve because I thought that was a mission that mattered. It ended up being one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done in my life. But those companies that we created are still killing it. It's not courage. It's humility. It's like, yeah, I'm willing to do the thing, even though I know I'm probably going to fail. But I'm humble enough to weather that. And so let's just go do that, because whatever it is I want to do, that needs to exist. If we knew how hard it was going to be when we started, I'm not sure we would have done it, because it sucked. It was really, really hard to get it to work. I don't know what you're doing, but if you're not measuring residual risk, it's not security. You're doing something else. We can win, but we have to think differently.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sinon Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Well, hey, Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's a delight always to talk to folks who I know a little bit, and you know, selfishly, I want to make sure I got you on here because you were one of the very first investors in ThreatSwitch, which became Sinon Solutions, which is the sponsor of this podcast, by the way.
Yep, that was another good investment.
It was. Hey, we gave you an exit, which, you know, is not always, doesn't always happen, I've heard.
For sure.
But that's okay. You learn something from the failures. But fortunately, we had a good exit, and there's no way we would have gotten it done without you and Mach 37. So it's super neat to have you on the podcast and talk about your thing, which is exciting. For those of you who haven't heard of Rick before, Rick ran Mach 37 for a while. You're CEO of Tidal Cyber. You've had a very diverse story and most recently raised a $10 million round at Tidal Cyber. So yeah, that's a pretty good resume on both cybersecurity and investments in general. So I think you're going to have some interesting things to say. But let me ask the first question, which is the one I always start with.
Sure.
How did you get started in security in general? Because most of the time it's a little bit accidental, and I'm always curious how folks get going.
Yes, great question. I've always been sort of drawn toward missions that matter. I graduated from high school, went to the Naval Academy, always wanted to serve because I thought that was a mission that mattered. When I left the military in 1996, wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I went to business school, got sucked into a Wall Street opportunity, which was pretty cool. But, you know, again, I was sort of missing that mission. It was pretty awesome doing IPOs, flying around in a G6, but it still was a little bit less fulfilling than I was hoping for. Went and took a shot at entrepreneurship in 1999. And then I pivoted serendipitously into another opportunity where there was a couple of entrepreneurs that were building an email security gateway back in 1999, so about 10 years earlier than it should have been. But we merged those two businesses, and then I ran it for the next 3 years. And it was, you know, I've sort of found a home because it was, you know, even at that time, we knew the bad guys were real. I think the world wasn't aware of that yet. But we knew what we were doing is important. I think we were really driven by that. And I've just sort of never left, you know, the security business aside from like a 2-year stint at, as you mentioned, Inova, helping run a corporate venture fund.
Yeah. You know, every submariner I've met is a little bit odd. always smart.
Very simple. That.
I'm curious what, you know, the early Navy stuff. Were you working on anything related to cyber in the Navy at all, or was it a complete pivot when you went into the venture space?
Not at all. I was, you know, an engineer by training, so I know how to sort of decompose a problem and solve the problem. I think that was a great set of skills that the Navy taught me, both in the academy and in the fleet as a Navy nuke and a submarine officer. I mean, those were just really applicable generic skills that I was able to apply. And it's nothing a metaphor doesn't cure anyway. Really, you'll appreciate this given your background as well. It's funny. One of the things I learned, I've never forgotten this, even as a midshipman, was in the first naval weapons engineering class I ever had to take. We learned about radio operator curves, basically rock curves that show probability of success versus probability of false alarms. I whip that out all the time with people, and they think I'm so smart, especially in cybersecurity. Our detections are, you know, our rock curves basically suck. We sort of admit it. But there are ways to actually engineer combinations of capabilities and security that actually bend the curve in the right direction. And all of that came from a sophomore class that I took at the Naval Academy. Isn't that funny?
If you're doing a talk at a conference and you want to give him a hook,
You can see all the guys in the military that have taken that class are like ready to high five me when I come up.
The 12 of them in the entire 10th.
Sure.
There are some somewhere.
Exactly.
But, you know, it is interesting, you know, that you mentioned that because a lot of the math, at least I've noticed, a lot of the math that we think about in, and not just cybersecurity, but in physical security and visitor management, Lean Six Sigma, process optimization, it tends to boil down to these same sorts of risk probabilistic problems that show up over and over and over again.
Yeah, for sure. I just wrote a blog yesterday where I start talking about the math. Even in cybersecurity, I've really been hammering this lately. It really is to highlight what we're doing in threat-led defense because it's new and different in the way that we're approaching the security problem. But it all does come down to the math of helping security leaders understand the adversary generally has to engage in a series of things. There are 14 canonical tactics that exist in the MITRE technology base. They don't have to do all of them. They have to do many of them. Well, when you recognize that that's what the adversary has to go through in order to get from recon to exfil or recon to encrypt, you start to recognize that the defender does gain a geometric advantage if along each step of the way I have the opportunity to detect or defend against and eliminate the adversary's ability to get from recon to impact. Then we can win the game. As an industry, we have not thought that way. But that is a sort of a classic, you know, national security, physical security paradigm where you're starting to think about design threats. What are the defensive capabilities that I can stack along the way and reduce the probability of success of the adversary to get there? That I've been committed to for the last 4 years. It is new, it is better, and it is disruptively making an impact in the security industry. And it's probably why we grew so much.
Yeah, that's really interesting because not everybody who listens to this podcast is going to be a cyber person, and it just doesn't matter.
Yeah. Lessons I learned when I did work around TSA personnel screening, lessons that I learned in trying to engineer better security processes when I ran operations for Clear. This was 20 years ago. All of these are still the same sort of security metaphors that we're using. We're just applying them to a different domain in a way that really is improving everything.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit what I'll call, I mean, you talked a little bit about the Navy background and your early venture work. Let's talk a little bit about your investor years, which is how you and I got to know each other. Mach 37, I mean, you must have seen hundreds of companies focused on security, cybersecurity, health tech for sure.
Yeah.
Just tell us a little bit about that story. What was Mach 37? How did you get involved in it? What were you doing there? And I'd love to ask some follow-ups on just what you learned.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll start from the beginning. I just left a threat intelligence platform company and had an idea for doing something similar in threat intelligence. I went to the Center for Innovative Technology where, you know, ended up building great friendships with the team there, but in particular, Pete Jobsy and Tom Weithman. And it's funny because I went there thinking they wanted me to pitch this idea for another version of TIP. And they listened politely for an hour. And then Pete said, Rick, well, listen, I really appreciate that. And if that's what you want to do, we'll probably fund it. But that's not why we wanted to talk to you today. Then he started to talk to me about this accelerator idea that Pete had. And that he and Tom had been working on this, what I thought was a really great idea. I think from an economic development perspective in Virginia, what they wanted to do was harness this rich ecosystem of talent that exists better than any place on the planet, even in Israel, between Fort Meade and Langley, and basically the DoD and the DHS security infrastructure that existed in that region. They wanted to harness that because they knew that there were either budding or unwitting entrepreneurs that were solving problems with technology that had real applicability in the commercial environment outside of sort of the traditional defense contractor ecosystem. And the hypothesis was if they only knew how to do this, how to go found a company, build a story, communicate that story that would resonate in a way that was consistent with what an investor wanted to hear, they would be able to attract that precious capital, attract those initial customers, and then move on to the next stage where they're getting real venture. And so that was Pete's idea. I think for me, I mean, I couldn't spell accelerator. Read a book about a Y Combinator, saw that Paul Graham had dinner every week. So I figured, well, that was one thing that we had to do. I think he cooked. I did not. We had it catered, thankfully. It ended up being one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done in my life. The investments were great. We made some really great investments in security product companies that went on to be super successful, at least one on an IPO track right now, that otherwise might not have existed had we not built this ecosystem that included training, engagement, collaboration, all the ingredients of successful entrepreneurial ecosystems, you know, basically cramming them into once a week into this facility that we had. It was super rewarding, and it really did take on a life of its own. It was really funny. I understood that we needed a mentor network to be credible. This was Rick dialing up all his friends in the industry saying, hey, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to come in and meet with our guys. That was humbling. The people that came to speak or teach that were supremely successful in different facets of the security ecosystem, that was pretty amazing. But what was really surprising to me was that we were asking people to become mentors and asking them if we could put them on LinkedIn just to start to build our credibility as a Mach 37 mentor. And all of a sudden it shifted where people were calling me because our brand had become important enough that other people that I thought were amazing wanted to align with us. It was pretty cool. And when it happened, all of a sudden we knew it had auto-catalyzed. Unfortunately, the Commonwealth couldn't continue to fund it forever. I think it was difficult to sustain it in the same way beyond that. And so we had to go off and find other things to do. But those companies that we created are still killing it. I mean, Huntress, of course, a lot of people have heard of, Threat Switch for sure, Steel Mountain, Adlumin, Black Kite, it used to be Norm Shield. All of those are really huge successes that I think.
Yeah, and the community that grew up around it. I mean, for my part, just my part, because of my experience at Mach 37, there's no way I would be doing the stuff in the startup mentoring and investments. And, I'm involved with Venture South and Techstars now. I wouldn't be doing any of that if it wasn't for you guys. There's no question. So I'm curious.
For sure.
A lot of other founders have that experience where, it's something that you want to be a part of, even if your company doesn't work.
I hope so. It's like what actually super interesting point. I do think we overinvested in educating these entrepreneurs how to do it and whether or not they were successful with their, and most are not. I mean, pre-seed investments are, it's still super high risk, right? We modeled 1 in 6. We got about 1 in 6, returned money to the fund. One of them returned, multiple times over. But that wasn't what it was about for us. For us, it was about building an ecosystem and teaching not only the entrepreneurs how to do it, but the community how to do it here. And we effectively did that. But our commitment to every entrepreneur that came into the program was that they would learn how to do this. They would get the equivalent of a master's degree education in cybersecurity entrepreneurship. They would know how to do it because they're likely to go do it again. And I come across them all the time where they just, they've done one thing, they've done another thing. Steel Mountain guys are a good example of that. Serial entrepreneurs had a good exit to Avast. Once you've done one, it takes a lot. You probably need a break between things, but you sort of never really lose the edge or the desire to go do another one.
Yeah. I don't even know how many, especially all the ones that pitched you that you didn't invest in. What did you learn about cybersecurity that you would share with other security leaders? That just in the process of seeing all of these very good ideas and some very good ideas that don't make it, but nonetheless are pretty good ideas. What are two or three nuggets that you take away from that experience that you
share? So it's the biggest ones are more about entrepreneurship than they were about cyber security specifically. And I think there's one just lesson that I think people, if you decide that you're going to go on this journey, you need to understand what the odds are and do it anyway. A good entrepreneur is going to sort of recognize that there are all these necessary but insufficient ingredients, and everything is necessary and insufficient unless you include luck. Huntress is the most successful of all the companies. I remember when Callahan Sloven was really, really struggling, right? And I think every successful company usually goes through that, unless there are probably some guys that started with a big bankroll. But at least in this Mid-Atlantic region, we all start out pretty poor and need to stay in business long enough to get a little bit of luck. Guys like you and Kyle and Rob Johnson, we're all able to weather that storm until you get a little bit of serendipity. It's funny, I used to say we would model 1 in 6 would be successful. We thought all 6 would be successful. We couldn't tell. I could never have told you which one, right? Because just shit happens. And I think as an entrepreneur, you've got to embrace that. Once you sort of embrace that as an entrepreneur, it's amazing how courageous you could be. It's not, somebody from my hometown, when I went home, it said something like, it was almost like an admiration, but they're like, I don't have the courage to do what you do from an entrepreneurship perspective. And I said, it's not courage. It's humility. It's like, yeah, I'm willing to do the thing, even though I know I'm probably going to fail. But I'm humble enough to weather that. And so let's just go do that. Because whatever it is I want to do, that needs to exist. Let's go do it. Yeah. And that's probably, like, that's the biggest lesson. It wasn't sort of, you know, specifically cyber-oriented, but, you know, hopefully it's, you know, important.
Well, the phrase you just mentioned was a belief that the thing needs to exist.
Yeah.
We just had Michelle Lambiasi on. Her episode just dropped not long ago. She's Chief Security Officer at SAIC. We talked a lot about the early stage company ecosystem, which was a surprising thing to be discussing with her because of the position she's in. But they just invested in a company called Nooks, Sean Blackman. It's one of those things where I met Sean early on, and they're a company that builds out skiff facilities for classified work for a variety of different companies. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, man, there are a hell of a lot of obstacles getting this done. I mean, this is going to be a battle. But he just believed. And Michelle's point in our conversation, and I'd love to get your take on this, was that despite the, you know, there's a lot more capital out there. Well, there are ebbs and flows, but there are certainly more entities providing capital than at any time, probably ever. They pull back from time to time and they get nervous. They have, you know, they're fickle. They do all the things they do. But for companies that are building security products of any kind, digital, physical, doesn't really matter, there's still a hell of a lot of obstacles that are unique to security, especially aerospace and defense related, that make it so difficult. And Michelle's point was that they feel like they have an obligation to try to figure out how to support these emerging companies. Yeah. And there, I mean, Andrew Hill is like came out of nowhere, they're really fast. I mean, it can happen. But I wanted to get your take on what you think those obstacles are and what the hell we should do about it.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly tackling one of those obstacles. And it was sort of as I mentioned earlier, I've been sort of in the threat intelligence arena since 2010 when I was at Looking Glass and never given up on the hope to be able to operationalize threat intelligence in a way that actually works. That has been a vexing problem. I'll just give you an example that will put a pretty fine point on it. If you're a security professional and I ask you, can you defend effectively against a tradecraft that's being used by an adversary of the day, Scattered Spider? If I can prove that if you give me an hour within, or give me an answer within the next 24 hours, that you totally guessed. But unfortunately, that's exactly what happens. Something pops up on Bloomberg News, something pops up on the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. I mean, cyber is a Main Street issue these days. The CEO, the CFO is picking that up, and they're going to the CISO and saying, hey, listen, how are we doing against Scattered Spider, as an example, or Kira as another one? To answer that question in an analytically honest or rigorous way, it's weeks and weeks of work. But they also, the CISO also sort of recognizes that if he doesn't give you or his or her boss an answer within the next 24 hours, then that boss isn't going to understand. And so what we end up doing is guessing. We end up guessing at a fundamental security question, if not the fundamental security question. Can I defend my assets in inventory or my assets in infrastructure effectively against the tradecraft that adversaries that I know are attacking us today are actually using? And if not, how should I apply my scarce resources in the most effective way to reduce residual risk by the greatest amount that's affordable? That's the job of the security professional from soup to nuts.
That's about the best definition I've heard.
In cyber security, we can't do it. We've never been able to do. Now, think physical security or national security. We spend lots of time and effort trying to understand what the design threat is. What are the bad guys going to try to do against us? Okay, that's the design threat. Now, what are our defenses? So these are the defenses that we built and designed, but these are intended to align effectively against the tradecraft that adversaries will use against us. And this game becomes a sort of organic cat and mouse game of, okay, well, this is where they've innovated. Okay, we're going to close that gap, or maybe that gap's already closed with this thing, this capability we didn't realize we had. But we continually do this analysis of threat and defense, threat and defense. And then we try to decide, okay, well, all the gaps that I'm aware of right now, what thing can I do or what investment can I make that actually reduces the greatest amount of residual risk by the greatest amount? And that's the job, right? In cybersecurity, up until sort of, you know, we built our company, you've never been able to do that. And that is arguably, that is security. And really, it's a little tongue in cheek, but, you know, if you're not doing that, what are you doing? I mean, we call that, is it compliance? Is it, you know, attack surface management, where I'm sort of deterministically, you know, I've got a bunch of patches I got to do, so let's just go patch. Well, okay, but like, how much residual risk am I reducing from, in this case, scattered spider, the things that they do, in their ability to actually gain access to the asset of the infrastructure that they want to get access to? That's where we're trying to push the industry.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a nice segue into talking about your shift to MITRE.
Sure.
Which in many ways, I guess, sort of teed up Tidal Cyber. So you're in this investment community for a long time. Mm-hmm. What was the impetus for shifting over to join MITRE? And thoughts on MITRE and their role in the cybersecurity community in general?
Profound, historically profound. I'm a little bit concerned about what's going on with funding available for FRDCs in particular, but the generational impact that MITRE has made, especially in security, national security, but cybersecurity in particular, it's been irreplaceable. And that is, it's a mission worthy supporting, and our government needs to continue to do that. The reason I went to MITRE, even when I was at Mach 37, I was aware when Blake Strom had created MITRE ATT&CK. And I've always been, not obsessed with, but sort of always thinking about, how do you solve this threat intelligence problem, basically answer that basic security question. And I saw what MITRE had done, or MITRE ATT&CK had done, was create a way to democratize the availability of threat intelligence by creating this sort of hierarchical tactics, techniques, and procedures framework for filing new events that are occurring, new reports that emerge in the open source. And then it's basically a hierarchical inventory of tradecraft that adversaries use, and MITRE made it available to everyone the way that MITRE does, right? They democratized threat intelligence in a way that had never been done before, and the world needed that, right? Critical infrastructure in the U.S. definitely needed that. They couldn't afford, teams can't afford to, you know, pay somebody for all that information. And I was really impressed by MITRE's sort of taking that and running with it and democratizing it. Just a real quick segue on that, just sort of philosophically, I've always loved threat intelligence. I've always thought it was problematic, though, that the way that we treat threat intelligence in our country is, or maybe in the world, is equivalent to this metaphor. Your neighbor's home gets broken into, gets robbed, right? You see the police next door, they're doing the investigation, they're figuring out how they get in. You walk across the street and ask the policeman, well, how'd they get in? And the policeman says, you have to pay me $1 million.
Yeah.
That's where we are. That's where we have been. And sort of the way that this, our community, our industry has really thought about threat intelligence, somehow the victim's data became the property of somebody doing the incident response report, or somebody, you know, and then that got turned into an asset that was kept intentionally scarce so that the individuals behind that business could make money. That doesn't make a lot of sense. MITRE did a lot to really disrupt that in a super positive way. So I always admired them. And of course, what they did with CVEs was also profound a decade earlier. I had gotten a call from Brian Ware, who I think had just left or was just leaving the administration. He mentioned something that was going on at MITRE that was really commercially focused, where MITRE was trying to drive the adoption of this MITRE ATT&CK knowledge base to protect critical infrastructure. They had a couple of really innovative programs over there that I thought were clever. The position that was open was actually running those, or actually, to be really fair, helping general managers that ran those to drive the adoption of the MITRE ATT&CK knowledge base by consumers of security capabilities, like large financial services company, large consulting firms, multinational industrial companies that MITRE was working with to help them understand how to integrate this knowledge of adversary behaviors into their security operations. Similarly, security product vendors, helping them describe in the same way the defensive capabilities that they were applying. For me, this was a big aha moment, which is, okay, so what MITRE is doing is getting the security vendors to structure and normalize their defensive capabilities in the exact same way that we're structuring and normalizing the way we describe adversary behaviors. So we could finally solve that last mile problem of threat intel. That's why I went there, because I really believed in what MITRE was doing. I knew about the pedigree, ended up meeting my two co-founders. They both worked with me in that group. I think we quickly got in sync with where we thought the industry needed to go, and that we probably needed to leave MITRE to go do this. But to the comment we made earlier, we knew 6 months into this that what we were envisioning needed to exist, and that the best way to make it exist was really to do what I knew how to do, which was to, you know, go put a plan together, go raise money, go sort of hit those sequential sets of milestones that, you know, can build a prototype, demonstrate the effectiveness, raise more money, build an enterprise platform, get your design partners lined up, convert them, build a funnel of customers, and then miraculously start closing them all. I mean, it's all part of the plan, but even today, right? I mean, I've done this a lot, right? Even today, I'm like, you get to the point, it's like, huh, that worked.
Just don't act surprised in front of the investors.
Never, never. You know you're going to get there, you're just not quite sure how.
Just for everybody's benefit who aren't familiar with MITRE ATT&CK, could you walk through, like, really, 101, what is MITRE ATT&CK? Discuss a little bit about what it is and how companies are using it now.
Yeah, lots of different use cases for it, but generally what MITRE ATT&CK began with is a structure for describing adversary behaviors. It became a repository, a knowledge base of adversary behaviors. Starts with open source threat intelligence or contributions from incident response or intelligence reports that come to MITRE. They get filed. If there's a unique behavior that's described, MITRE will create a new adversary behavior. The way that the structure works is hierarchical. It starts with across the top 14 tactics, all of which sort of represents, you know, an adversary objective and the techniques that the adversary can choose from in order to affect an objective. Procedures have been less enumerated, I think, than the technique and sub-technique level. We've actually spent a lot of time trying to enumerate what procedures are. Essentially combinations of variants of specific techniques. I like to say it's more like a Dewey Decimal System, where they have a structure that we can file these canonical set of tactics, which really never change anymore, or very rarely change, the techniques that adversaries of all types would use to affect each of those given tactics, and then procedures that describe more specifically that are more applicable for threat hunting use cases, detection engineering use cases. It created lingua franca across the industry, so threat intelligence organizations could start describing what they were seeing within the same context, so you didn't have to learn multiple different languages to be able to communicate with one threat intelligence provider versus another threat intelligence provider. So that was the beginning of it. You know, I think when customers started using this to try to, one, structure threat intelligence in a way that they'd never been able to do, which is sort of like, okay, well, if I'm reading threat intelligence, it's useful for me to understand who's it, I'm reading a threat intelligence report. It's like someone's attacking somebody with something. That's what's the essence of what's in it. What I really want to know is who's attacking me with what. The problem with threat intelligence historically has been I got to pay expensive people to read that thing, even if they don't have to read it, because you've got to get through it to understand whether or not there's any context in that report that applies to my business. When you can get it structured like ATT&CK does, it's super easy for me to understand. For my kind of business, these are the adversaries that attack me. These are the tools that they use. These are the combination of techniques that have been known to be employed by these adversary groups. Therefore, these are the techniques that I need to worry about the most. That's the first part. So from a threat intelligence use case perspective, we do a thing called threat profiling. We're not the only ones that do it, but it's helpful to sort of automate the contextualization of threat intelligence to which behaviors matter, which ones represent highest levels of risk to my business. The second app is a little more complicated. When the security vendor community started adopting the same approach, what we were able to do is start to figure out, okay, well, if I've got this complex stack of an EDR, a SIEM, maybe custom rules that exist on my SIEM, next-gen firewall, email security gateway, et cetera, I start to build stacks of defensive capabilities that exist across the techniques that I need to worry about, right? And that gives vendors the ability to do a SOC assessment where I have a sense of, okay, these are not only the adversaries I need to worry about, these are the techniques that they use, these are the defensive capabilities that I have, this is what's turned on and how they intersect. So customers are using this to understand a view of residual risk in a way that is that scales, right? Yeah. So that's like a good use case. Lots of use cases around sort of stack optimization. If you've got a stack and you can't afford the stack, understanding, okay, if I eliminate a thing, what is the implication to that to coverage against the behaviors that I need to worry about? Lots of offensive security approaches like breach attack simulation, red teaming, purple teaming, trying to understand, okay, if I'm seeing this in threat intelligence, what test do I need to develop that emulates what we've seen in threat intelligence? I can test whether or not my EDR, for example, works against this procedural variant that we've seen in the CTIs. MITRE ATT&CK enables all of that because of the structure that it's put around threat intelligence in a way that had never been done before.
Yeah. You and your co-founders, you're helping build it out.
Sure.
I'm thinking deeply about how customers are using it. What was the moment when you or one of the three of you or the three of you all at once realized, hold on a second, this needs to be a venture?
Yeah, it's probably sometime around August of 2021 where we were sort of evaluating, you know, could we do this at MITRE? We knew the thing needed to exist at that point. It doesn't take a genius to sort of figure out when business objectives don't necessarily align. Just a classic example, right? So you've done this. To build a SaaS product, you have to make a capital investment. And that takes, it's not an inconsequential sum of money. It's a lot cheaper than it used to be, but it's never inconsequential. You've got to build a prototype, eliminate enough ambiguity that you can raise money to build an enterprise product. That's step one, I have enough money to actually build the thing. Step two is I have enough money to sustain the thing, improve it, and eliminate churn. Step three, I have enough money to drive sales enough so that my gross margins exceed my fixed cost, right? That's sort of, you know, how it's done, right? It's difficult to do that from inside a nonprofit organization. And so we sort of recognized that early and just decided to, you know, decided we could go do this. And it took us some time. But, you know, so far it's been really successful.
I'm thinking back to that first year or two, 21, 22.
Yeah.
You'd seen a lot of companies do this and you've done it before yourself, but I suppose everyone is a little different. What was the hard part in this one? Where did you meet the most resistance? And it could be an R&D thing or it could be a fundraising thing.
What we wanted to build was incredibly ambitious, right? It's not just software. It's not just content. It's both. Both require fixed costs that created the capital, you know, an unusual level of capital intensity that would be required to get this thing through the gauntlet. So we knew it was going to be a little more expensive to build this thing because it's a combination of subject matter expertise in detection engineering, adversary emulation, and threat intelligence integrated into a platform that had to be built by people that knew how to do that, right? And so that was expensive. It did require a lot of integrations with third-party vendors, which some are easy to integrate with, some are not. That was also a core competency that we developed that we underestimated how difficult that was going to be. It's still difficult. I mean, we still philosophically will integrate with anybody. We don't really need to integrate with everybody. But if the customer really wants it, we'll do it. Once we've done the integration, we want to keep it. But, you know, that was harder to build, all of it, than I think we originally thought. It's funny. I'm not sure if we knew how hard it was going to be when we started. I'm not sure we would have done it because it sucked. It was really, really hard to get it to work. But again, we got it to work in December 22. It's like, huh, that worked. So that was a piece of it. The other piece was 23 was hard. From a fundraising perspective, I don't remember it being that bad. I wasn't raising in 2008. I was affiliated with another couple of venture companies that were raising it in 2008 when it was difficult. But I remember trying to raise in, and I did. I raised in when the bubble burst in 2002, 2003. That was really hard. 2023 was harder. I think a lot of VCs that were up market, had bigger funds, were trying to go down market. Early stage is not for the faint of heart. It is harder than what they do. It's hard to get it right. All kinds of things can go wrong. I think they ended up overinvesting in companies that had valuations that weren't appropriate for the level of risk that was still remaining in the business. And they all ended up losing their shirts, a lot of them, right? And I think the LPs got wise to that. There was a shift back. I think in cybersecurity in particular, where I think there was a lot of irrational exuberance, and evaluations that organizations or companies were getting in 2021, 22, and it just shifted the other direction. Even the serious security investors, I think, were having a crisis of confidence about their investment theses in the space, and we all suffered from it. It was really tough. And thankfully, I did find a great investor in Squadra that made the investment in my Series Seed round in spite of it. Right? Yeah. They had a lot of conviction in us, and it's going to work out for them really well. But you know, they didn't have to do that. But I remember in 22, we were small then, so you know, we had options, but like having an unacceptably low level of money in the bank account before we actually closed the round. Same in 23. It was like we all threaded needles.
That is a very polite way of saying you were broke. The last time I checked.
It felt broke.
Oh, I knew exactly what it feels like.
we were young Turks, right? And I just remember, especially in the military, like we'd run towards stress. I remember vividly fire on the submarine. We all ran toward it. Everyone ran toward the danger because what's the alternative, right? So this is how I was wired. Even as an entrepreneur, run toward the risk because if not me, who?
Yeah.
Right? As I have gotten older, the ability to process that stress and that cortisol has definitely diminished. So, you know, I'll talk to even Kyle Hanslope, and we'll talk a lot about this, you know, because he's been fabulously successful, but it's been rough, right? And it's like self-care is a real thing. It's not something I ever appreciated, even through my 40s. But as I hit my 50s, definitely something that was like, it's different this time.
For sure. Hopefully, we have a little bit more capital reserve personally to weather the
fire. I'm not going to starve.
Like, you could hire somebody to put out the fire if you have to. There are a variety of reasons why one might not run toward the fire quite as quickly. I completely understand what you're talking about. On Tidal Cyber specifically, we talked a little bit about what was hard, but tell everybody a little bit about the problem solution stack here. What exactly is Tidal Cyber doing? How is that unique in the marketplace? And how are you hoping to take this thing forward, especially now that you've raised this A round?
Yeah, so the category that we're in is threat-led defense. It is markedly different. If you think about the way security in our industry has evolved over the last 15 years, heavily focused on attack surface, heavily focused on asset visibility, heavily focused on the existence of vulnerabilities in the environment. And we're at the point now where we knew we were going to be, which is there are too many of them and can't patch them all. And so what does that mean within context of risk to the business? All of those are increasingly intractable problems to solve because there are just so many to deal with. I think the same is true on event management. We saw SIEM was all about compliance. We started collecting information, found it novel to ask questions of the information from a preventative perspective as opposed to an incident response perspective. Then we started to realize, there are too many of those events because our ROC curve sucked on those detections. And then I created SOAR to try to automate the workflow around managing that. It turns out too many of those to manage. It's become an intractable problem. What we think is important is to look at the problem from the other perspective. Start from the adversary first. There are 15 to 20,000 new CVEs that are released every year. There are about 700 techniques and sub-techniques that exist in attack, but that's human manageable. Each of those, attack surface and adversary tradecraft, are equal parts of the risk equation. This side is infinitely more tractable than this side. Start here. And so if we're talking about the theory behind it, it is superior to start from this direction. And we couldn't do it before because MITRE ATT&CK didn't exist. We didn't have defensive capabilities that sit between the attack surface and the adversary and their tradecraft. We didn't have that enumerated in structure in the same way. All of that is done now. So now we have the ability to actually understand what the likelihood that an adversary can effectively get from recon to impact to an asset, whatever that asset might be. But if we can reduce the probability of success down to an acceptable level, even in light of an existence of a vulnerability that might enable initial access, but not every other technique the adversary has to engage in, we have a real, not even a fighting chance, we have an advantage in that approach. And so that's what we're doing. We really started there. I would like to say I started with that theory from day one. I think our ambitions were a little more focused on that basic question, can I defend X against Y? And almost just being incredulous that as an industry, we can't do that. And by the way, everyone should be. We should be insane that we've not been able to answer that question. It's really unforgivable. But for a lot of reasons, most of which are not great reasons, we haven't been able to do it. So that's another vexing question to answer, but it wasn't an intractable one. And we knew we could solve it. And so, you know, that's what Title Cyber is doing. It's, you know, we built the enterprise product in 23, had some great design partners, converted them, started building a funnel, mostly upmarket. Our customers, the ones that we're mostly closing now, are sophisticated CISOs that understand that to do security, you have to be able to answer that question. Can I defend X against Y? And if they are getting away with it, they shouldn't be getting away with it, that they can't answer the question. So our customers want to stop guessing. And it just so happens that the population of people that sort of recognize that are sophisticated CISOs, maybe from regulated industries, getting CISO jobs that are in unregulated industries, are carrying that ethos with them, which is like, you can't get away with this anymore. Like, you can't be a security professional and not ask and answer this question, right? And so we are growing pretty rapidly. I think at this point, we're not just growing, we're leading. We're really helping people understand, look, this is a must-have. You have to answer this question. If you're not answering this question, I don't know what you're doing. It's not really security. It's compliance or checking boxes or making your boss feel better when it's not warranted, but it's not security. You've got to do this to do security, and this is a really efficient way to do it. We won't be the only ones that do this. I do think it's going to be a great outcome for us. We'll see how far we're able to take it.
What you're describing in customer and buyer, companies that are buying security products and services in general, my experience is very similar to yours in that, I mean, and now to some extent, we're the beneficiary because we're selling a lot of compliance and experience kinds of products and services. The deficiency was always there in terms of this, a very narrow view. One part of the organization was doing the buying and they only approached the buy from a really narrow perspective, which might be compliance or it might be security or it might be physical or it might be information. Kind of everybody had their hat that they were buying for and they didn't really talk to each other very well. That was one challenge. And I'm just curious what your experience is when you go into an enterprise buyer, especially buyer of security products and services, and a lot of folks who are doing the buying, hopefully are listening to this podcast so they can get better at it.
Yeah.
They have to make a financial justification for spend. Like, I mean, that's when you operate a company for profit, you have to. How should they think about the calculus of return on investment for investments that have a real holistic view of security that's not only based on compliance?
That's a great question. Obviously, we built the product to make security better, and we can prove it. As soon as we set up a platform in a customer's environment, I can show them exposures that they need to close. They haven't closed. They didn't know they had them. They didn't know they had the capabilities to close them. We can close them immediately. And that becomes organic. I think that is hard to put an ROI on that, right? It's a security ROI. We've been selling into that, those headwinds forever. Do it anyway because the customer needs capability and we'll just be patient as they come around. So that's why we built it. Right. ROI is easier for us to tell in a couple of different ways, though. One is, you know, I ask that basic question. Okay. You're a CISO. Can your team defend against Scattered Spider? Well, I don't know. Let me go ask. Well, if they come back within a day, I'll prove that they guessed. They didn't do the analysis. Okay. So we've agreed that that's what happened. And you agree that you have to be able to answer this question. Well, go answer it. How long will it take you? It's going to be weeks. It'll be weeks of work trying to figure out. First part's reasonably easy if you've got a threat intelligence capacity, what behaviors matter. The most difficult piece of that is what the relative risk of any given behavior is over another. That does require expertise in MITRE ATT&CK. Not everybody has it. Most people don't. If you're good at it, you can do it quickly. If you're not good at it, it'll take you a long time. But that gives you a sense of which behaviors matter more than others from an inherent risk perspective. The more difficult piece is then sort of understanding, okay, well, can I defend against it? Or more importantly, which of those do I suck at defending against, right? And that process is long and drawn out and even more complicated. It's sort of trying to understand, okay, well, then of all the things that I have where I have unacceptable levels of residual risk, what is my next best action to be able to ameliorate that risk by the greatest amount? Again, another many days of work. And this is just on a simple question that gets asked all the time. Anytime there's a headline about a new adversary group in Bloomberg or whatever, that we did a benchmark study with one of our large customers, insurance company, that we basically asked a senior detection engineer and a junior analyst. The senior detection engineer did not have our platform. And we asked the question, okay, well, we did half the work, which is another ransomware group. We basically said, okay, these are the behaviors. This is the relative risk. Can you defend against it? And we bound it by a six-hour period. To his credit, that senior engineer manually was able to find one gap and recommended a remediative action for that gap. Just by comparison, within 30 minutes, the junior engineer had 11 enumerated and recommendations to fill those. And like that's 132x efficiency gain, right? And so the first step, though, may require a sophisticated security leader to admit that to do security, you have to ask and answer this question. And so that's really what we're trying to get people to understand is like, I don't know what you're doing, but if you're not measuring residual risk, it's not security. You're doing something else.
Yeah. And I love how effectively I could take that and deploy it in visitor management too at my old job. It's like, okay, if you're facility security, can you defend against somebody who's impersonating an employee with a fake badge? Go. Yeah. And if they can't really answer that question,
yeah,
what are you doing?
I mean, what is it you call what you're doing? It's theater. I mean, Bruce Starr would probably say it's theater, right? Yeah. It's more well intended than that. I think it's like a lot of people get into habits. It's never been practical to do this before. Answering that question was never practical. And I know that most customers, unless they've been doing this, can't do it. The question is, can they really intellectually, honestly argue that they shouldn't be doing it?
Now, with this Series A, and well, number one, tell us a little bit about it. And two, what's the plan? I mean, this I'm sure it was a slide in the deck. What's the use of funds?
Yeah, I mean, all the normal things, right? I think Pixel was the lead participation by a lot of our existing investors already. Pixel was introduced to us by another co-investor friend from Blue Ventures, really like this investment team. A couple of reasons. One, they're easy to get along with and they get us. They understand the vision of what we're doing. They have a pretty strong security investment portfolio, some of which could be complementary to us over time. So that was useful. The European fund. And we've actually grown quite a bit in Europe. I think for whatever reason, this sort of residual risk story that we have resonates more with European sensibilities. And we seem to have grown significantly there without having to make a huge investment, and having a European-based fund really help us sort of figure out how to leverage that strength and grow more quickly. It was a huge advantage for us. Glad the round is done. We've got significant capital to continue to grow. It'll probably be equal split between product and engineering and go to market. We are incredibly capital efficient. I think you know this, right? I spent a lot of time even teaching you guys how to model when you were at Mach 37, how to model your business. The answer is not in the model, it's the process, right? It's basically stating your assumptions, coming up with approaches to measure how accurate those assumptions were. And then over the period of time, you learn your business at a very low level of abstraction so that there are no surprises. So I've got 24 months of operating data on go-to-market from lead to close, every stage, time and stage. All of that is baked. And so we know where to make the investments in lead gen and sales and engineering and SDRs and AEs, and already seeing the ability to scale very quickly. So all that's working really well. Our LTV to CAC is super attractive. What I would consider, it's got to be top decile. And so our SaaS metrics are, I think, best of breed. And so like it's just the business, right? And it's working really well. And we keep making these investments, and we'll make the investment and we'll try to, project what we think the improvement on our metrics are. And all of that is working really well. And so that's execution. We are just going, we have a couple bodies to build, but no, like we'll have to learn a bunch of new tricks to execute on the next 2 years really well. We're just going to do it. The engineering side or the product side, I think, I've got a really strong focus on the go-to-market side. I am able to shift my focus back to product along with the co-founders as well. There are things we have not, clearly we built enough of a good product that I can sell a lot of it to sophisticated customers. There are so many more things that we want to do that I think will continue to satisfy customer needs in provocative ways like we've already done from a competitive perspective, create additional moats. Those are all strategic luxuries we just never had before until we could get the A done. But now we can start to think about, okay, well, we've got this thing built. It's working really well. We've actually added a couple more things that have, like procedural objects we just released. That's game changing in a big way. And we'll just keep doing those things to continue to grow the company, add more value to the customer. We are big focus on the customer now. We've been successful. Now's the time to take an air of skepticism around, okay, well, do we really know what the customers need? What do the customers love most about our capabilities? What are the customers most disappointed in? I'm just like viciously focused on getting that answer. Like top three things that we're not doing well enough. What do we got to do to fix those? Right. And then once we eliminate those three, what are the next three? Those are the things I think that we're really starting on and applying money to that we just didn't have before we got the A done.
That's great. Super exciting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the future that you're moving this company into at an abstract level. I mean, where we are headed in security over the next 5 to 10 years. I would be remiss if I did not say the word AI.
AI?
Somebody's going to ask. I'm sure it's not the first time you've been asked. But what do you think the big things are over the next 5, 10 years in this space? Is AI important or not? Is it more of a threat or more of an opportunity? Or what are the other things that we're not even talking about? They could be completely unrelated to AI.
I'm a little old school. We use AI, by the way. We never could have done, unless we made an acquisition about a year ago of an AI company that we loved that could do stuff that nobody else could do. The accuracy that we could interpret threat intel in particular into objects that were consistent with attack was something we'd never seen before. Harrison Van Riper started that company. He's a member of our team, is a huge asset. AI is going to be important, but I would say I'm just a little bit old school. I've been here before. Every trend that we've seen over the last 30 years is like, okay, yeah, saw that before. This is what happened. Saw that the hype is around it. The AI bubble will burst. I think there will be, from a capital perspective, an overreaction to that in a way. I think that is not great for the AI industry. It's like, yeah, that didn't work. Well, yes, some of it worked. Some of it didn't work. A lot of you knuckleheads are making investments, over-investing in things that really, you know, there wasn't enough addressable market for all of those investments to work. I think for us, AI is important to the extent that it, especially that it is able to democratize the availability of advanced capabilities to downmarket customers. I think you've already seen it with threat intelligence. We're doing that with AI and threat intelligence now, where we are taking a lot of the labor. We've imbued our AI with the knowledge that we have around adversary behaviors. We're taking the labor out of it and able to process more threat intelligence at speed. We're now making that available to our customers that have the same vexing problem. And so that, but again, it's about, in those cases, those are mostly bigger customers that were already dealing with threat intelligence. They just couldn't, there aren't enough people. There aren't enough people that know how to do it, right? And they're super expensive. So what I do believe will happen, though, is that because we're able to do that, we end up democratizing it down market so that customers can have the benefit of it, but they don't have to be experts in it because we've made it cost effective to be able to help any customer, any size, understand who's attacking my company with what can I defend effectively against it? What's my residual risk look like? There's lots of applicability for us in AI and to other use cases. Once we've taught machine learning to do this thing with MITRE ATT&CK, pivoting on that in other use cases is actually pretty easy. There's a whole lot in our pipeline of new features that are enabled by that we can continue to push.
Yeah. Now, the one side of this that I worry about a little bit, I've done one or two talks on it and I've talked to guests about it, is the exact same thing you've described, which is the democratization of access of these tools, not only to us, but to our adversaries. And what that does to the threat environment, and certainly nation state actors, but now you've got tools in the hands of every chucklehead with access to a GPU, can do pretty sophisticated stuff that begins to, I mean, an attacker that follows a particular pattern is one thing. An attacker that is autonomous and can change its tactics, including writing its own scripts midstream while it's attacking to do other things that it wasn't trained to do, is a little scary. And I'm curious what your customers are saying about that. And is that our future? How do we adapt to it?
So I think they're concerned about it. I don't think we've seen as much empirical evidence that, you know, as we're worried about at this point in time, but it's inevitable. right? One of the things I think that you can get some solace out of the fact that, you know, if, you know, human or machine decides to pivot a little bit with the implementation of a given technique, create a new procedure to execute something, the artifacts of whatever that new exploit do exist. In many cases, those artifacts, if you're asking the right kinds of questions and you're building the right kinds of detections that are not quite so brittle, you're going to pick them up anyway. You may not pick them all up, but you just got to remember, you're given many opportunities. Like, the breach isn't the initial access, right? The adversary has a lot more work to do to get from, you know, my intern's computer to a workload that exists in one of our production environments, right? And so each one of those steps represents an opportunity for us to do that detection. Now, if we're aware of the universe of capabilities that the adversaries that we care about are actually using, the likelihood is we'll pick those up along the way. It may be one thing for AI to innovate and create one new one or one novel approach that maybe we don't have a detection for, but not all of them. I think the likelihood of that happening in a sequence of cascading sets of completion of tactics is pretty small. Either that or really, really expensive.
Yeah, makes sense. My most recent work in this area, of course, has been in and around compliance, to a lesser extent, physical security, visitor management solutions. And a theme that I've picked up in talking to a lot of guests is the walls between what you say security pretty consistently, and you don't actually say cyber very often. But cybersecurity is kind of an arbitrary, weird thing that we call a certain class of problems.
Yeah.
That, you know, and to your credit, you've made it very clear that security is kind of security. It doesn't really matter that it happens to be cyber. But we still have in these organizations, especially the ones that you're selling to, that I sold to, that are hopefully listening, that, you know, you have information security, you have physical security, you have facilities, you have personnel security, you have cyber, you have national security. To what extent are these distinctions nonsense? And are we hopefully headed toward an environment where we can begin to break these things down? Is it an important problem or not? Is it creating artificial barriers?
No doubt. I think the same metaphors prevail from one domain to the next. All of a sudden, we have to use different kinds of terminology. You know, I mean, I'm as nerdy as the next guy, right? And so I sort of dig understanding some of the vernacular. But even as old as I am, I can't possibly keep up, right? But the principles don't change, right? I think I don't want to indict anybody for actually perpetuating these barriers, but I do think it's actually, you know, we've seen it hurt the cybersecurity community because we tend to get into the weeds because of something that was incredibly wonky, when that's not the most appropriate way to communicate. Okay, well, here's the risk to the business. At the end of the day, the C-suite cares about the risk to the business. It's not even the value of the asset they care about. What they care about is, okay, well, does it take the business down? What does it cost me to remediate? What's the impact to brand, right? All of those things are not as integrated into the thinking that we do in cybersecurity as we ought to. We do have good partners. I have a great partner that actually thinks about this, a guy named Chris Correa at CGS Cyber. It's just consistently trying to bring everything back to that story, which I think is super important. And once the cybersecurity community actually starts to learn to communicate that way, we're going to be a lot better off.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, time for some rapid fire. I'm going to ask a few questions. Quick, pithy answers. Not all of them are that serious. The first one, I might know the answer to this already. Most overhyped buzzword right now.
Oh, AI.
Dumbest security habit execs cling to, at least the ones that you hang around with.
Oh, passwords on stickies.
Passwords in general, you could argue. The stickies is next level. Hopefully, but unfortunately, I think there probably are still some passwords on stickies. One Navy lesson that you think every leader should be applying.
Is this family? Okay, I'll say it.
Are you kidding me?
I just had lunch with my commanding officer last week, a guy named Bill Burke, great guy. Got 3 stars. What he said was, we were in the bridge. As its most senior junior officer, I was conning out the submarines. They were pulling out, or getting ready to pull out. And all of a sudden, like, he hears one of the chief or senior chief downstairs, like, drop the F-bomb. He just starts chuckling. He could hear all the way up the sail, right? And he goes, Rick, I love when I hear that. I go, well, why, sir? And he's like, because shit's getting done. So, I mean, great Navy lesson. It's like, okay, you get it. It's like people are intense. They want to get stuff done. Nobody takes it personally. We just, everybody's like just focused on the mission. Even before this call, I had a conflict or a call with one of my coworkers that was having some conflict with another coworker. I welcome that. That's, I mean, it's healthy. Have the conflict, have it in private, but have the conflict, get it resolved. Let's go.
The reason I've been reading biographies aggressively this year, and the one thing I've told everybody who will listen from every meaningful biography that I read is that the folks who achieve pretty awesome stuff, I mean, they're wrapping knuckles left and right.
Yeah.
Like there isn't a lot of handholding when you're trying to accomplish pretty significant things.
I like everybody.
It's not good to be personal. All right, one more. A bold or unpopular prediction for the future of security.
You hear it all the time. It's like, you know, the adversary has an asymmetric advantage. We're never going to win. They only have to be right once. We have to be right every time. That's just not true. The adversary has a lot of work to do, right? It's not landing on an endpoint because they got somebody to click on a fish, which is pretty easy to do. It's much more than that. And if we would just sort of wake up to the fact that it's not just initial access we're worried about, it's everything else. And there are plenty of opportunities to asymmetrically advantage the defender, to take advantage of it if you would just embrace that approach. That's, you know, so maybe that's my prediction, is like we'll start to recognize that that whole notion of it's a fait accompli is just bullshit.
Yeah.
We can win, but we have to think differently.
That's great. So winning is the prediction. That's the, there you go.
There you go.
We're going to win.
Yeah.
Bold and unpopular, but possibly true. If we do the right things, I suppose. So, Rick, this has been a delight. I mean, hearing your story, your journey from being surrounded by water to getting Tidal Cyber going. By the way, is Tidal a Navy reference? What is the Tidal part?
So it's Threat Informed Defense was like what we were doing.
I get it.
Writer. And yeah. So literally I called Rich and said, hey, can you run a dictionary script on TID and come up with the coolest words?
I get it.
And it was unanimous.
I just thought you liked water still.
Well, that was, we do. And of course I have a Navy pedigree, so it seemed to fit.
It works. But hearing the whole thing is, it's an awesome journey. And it was fun for me to be a part of it for a brief period of time when we were working together as part of Threat Switch. So that's fantastic. Really appreciate you taking the time today. And for those of you who want to check out Tidal Cyber, it is TidalCyber.com. Yes, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
You've got the URL. Excellent. And for those of you wanting to learn more about Sign In Solutions, you can find out more about us at signinsolutions.com. And with that, thank you, Rick. It's been a delight.
Likewise.
Have a great day.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time. Stay secure, stay informed.